Well, good morning. Show is Fight the Empire, and this is Per Fagrang. And my guest today is Professor Stephen Cohen, who is a professor emeritus at New York University and Princeton University. He has written books on Russia and many articles on Russia. And today we're going to talk about Ukraine. Professor Cohen, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Well, I was going through some old newspaper clippings in my files, and this kind of thing in Ukraine has been going on for quite a while.
That's because Ukraine, in some fundamental way, is not one country, but at least two. Some people think it's five, but that's too hard for me to think about.
Mm-hmm.
The eastern and southern geographic parts of the country are, in the fullest sense of the word, Russian. Ethnically, linguistically, religiously, culturally, politically, and economically. Those sections of the country are bound to Russian industry, to the Russian market. And by the way, in those areas of the country, there's a lot of intermarriage. I don't know the number, but I'd bet 50% of the nominal Ukrainian citizens of those parts of the country are married to Russians. The western part of Ukraine, which includes Kiev, the capital, historically has been closer to Poland, Sweden, and Lithuania. And it's interesting that in the recent protests in the streets and on the government level, where the European Union has pushed the Ukrainian government to sign an economic agreement with the European Union, the diplomatic or political leaders of the European Union have been the Lithuanians, the Poles, and the Swedes. So what you're seeing playing out in the streets of Kiev and at the highest levels between the leaders of Russia and Ukraine and the deal they signed yesterday, which brings Ukraine closer to Russia, is a historic division in the country that will not go away. And the end result may be, politically, two Ukraines, a partitioning of the country. Hasn't come to that. But that's why, as you say, when you go through the old newspaper files, we see this story before.
Well, didn't Ukraine used to be, or at least the western part, or wasn't it at one time part of a sort of a Polish mini-empire?
Well, you know, used to be, you know how historians are, they'll start telling you the story in the 12th century. But that's true, what you say, until World War One. Ukraine, large parts of Ukraine were in Western, not the Russian Empire. In part, were in the Russian Empire. It was only in 1921, I think, after the Russian Civil War, that the Red Army, the Soviet Army, finally drove all the foreigners out of what is now Ukraine, including the German Army, which had occupied Ukraine. And Ukraine became a republic of the Soviet Union. It was the Ukrainian Soviet Republic until December 1991, just almost 25 years ago, when the Soviet Union ended. And since then, the new drama's begun. Where does Ukraine go? East, west, or does it stay in the middle? Because geographically, it is between Russia and the European Union, and forge some kind of relationship with both. But the events of the last three or four weeks have shown, whether caused by popular opinion or the leaders of Russia and of the European Union, a kind of either-or approach.
Well, this In your interview you did with John Batchelor, you say that actually the U.S. is supporting a mob rule in Ukraine.
Well, let me refine that a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, perhaps because Obama's plate is full, perhaps because Obama desperately needs the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, to achieve diplomatic success in Syria and Iran, the United States has not played a leading role. It's true that Senator John McCain has been in the streets of Ukraine, but he's in the streets of any country that's anti-Russian. This is his kind of personal foreign policy. It's also true that the State Department sent a representative there, Victoria Nuland, who's a deputy secretary of state. But generally speaking, the march on Ukraine by the West has been through the European Union. And I don't know that I told John it was mob rule, but my thought was this. The current government of Ukraine, headed by President Yanukovych, was democratically elected. All Western observers agreed that that was a free and fair election. So he's the constitutional president of Ukraine. When you have hundreds of thousands of people in the street demanding that he resign or that he call new elections, and they are egged on by representatives of Western democracy, in effect, the Western democracies have become the anti-democratic force. It's very bad for any country. We know this. When a country is in some kind of transition towards stable democracy, to end a constitutionally elected government through protests in the streets, that's not democracy, it's something else. So if the people of Ukraine are fed up with their government, and by the way, polls tell us that many Americans are fed up with Obama, you wait till the next election. And the next election is not far off. It's in 2015. So when I said that the United States and its European allies were promoting anti-democratic developments in Ukraine, that's what I meant.
Well, you have a sizable group of people. They want Ukraine to be sort of part of the European Union. And yep. Considering how the how things are going in Europe, it seems to me like a drowning man trying to climb aboard a sinking ship. It's what does the European Union have to offer?
Well, you raise a question that the American media are rarely raised. The mainstream American press has taken it for granted that it would be very good for Ukraine economically to join the, it's not actually joining the European Union, it's an economic association. It doesn't carry with it membership. What the Europeans were offering Ukraine was a deal where they would give them a modest size loan, hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, that may sound like a lot of money, but Ukraine needed about $15 billion, if not more, just to avoid going bankrupt, defaulting on its sovereign debt. In return, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, required, as it does of all countries, that Ukraine impose on its people these austerity programs that have so racked Greece and Spain and other European countries. They mean cutting social services, what we would call Social Security, Medicare, the benefits program. It would mean ending subsidies for energy, for housing, for almost every enterprise that the government's in the area of welfare, and opening its borders to Western goods. I think, and I'm not alone in this, and this has been the Russian position, that that would have been catastrophic for Ukraine and for its people. That Ukraine, even if its ultimate destiny is some affiliation economically with Europe, is in no condition to do that now. It would have simply collapsed the suffering on ordinary people, of ordinary people, over the next 2 or 3 years would have been enormous. And that is why, I think, it was not Putin's bullying that brought the Ukrainian government to sign the accord with Russia yesterday, but the stark facts that what Europe was offering was what it called civilizational affiliation, what we would call ideology. If you want to be virtuous and liberal and democratic, sign. But the economic price will be very painful. Russia said, we're going to give you $15 billion loan, and we're going to discount your energy supply, most of which comes from Russia, to Ukraine, by nearly a third. So that makes the Russian package worth probably, I mean, the numbers vary, about $18 billion a year for the next 2 years. That gives Ukraine a chance at economic stability. And for ordinary Ukrainians, whether they're anti-Russian or they're anti-European, whether they're anti-Semites or they're Democrats, it avoids a terrible hardship of the kind we've seen in Europe.
Well, I was just going to say that they can look at Greece and Spain and Italy as sort of, this is what they would probably get under European hegemony, or whatever you want to call it.
Well, we should add, to be fair, that the Ukrainian economy desperately needs reform. It's corrupt, it's oligarchical. But whether you can impose reform on another country through harsh economic measures seems extremely unlikely. It failed in Russia in the 1990s when we imposed, or we urged them to undergo what we called then shock therapy. It failed from a social point of view, and now political point of view, in several European countries. And Ukraine today is in a more weakened condition than were those countries when they went through that ordeal. Now, if we back up, and this is a heretical thought in America, but I think empirically it can be substantiated. None of this is really about economics, primarily. This whole European Union financial package proposal to Ukraine, at least as it's viewed in Russia, and I don't think this is unreasonable, is another stage in the Western march led by the United States on post-Soviet, post-communist Russia since 1992. It began with the expansion of the Western military alliance, NATO, which is now right on Russia's borders. It continued with this plan to build anti-missile defense systems near Russia, which Russia sees as related. It's now a NATO project. Russia sees aimed at its deterrent capability. And now we have the economic or financial component of this march. And the proponents of this foreign policy, both in Europe and America, have said publicly, without any apology, that the prize of the march, the Western march on Moscow, is Ukraine, Russia's largest territorially and most populous Slavic brother or sister. Russia was born in Ukraine. Ukraine was born in Russia. For centuries, they were one country. That the march, the victory, the ultimate victory of the West over Russia is the capture of Ukraine. And remember one other thing. These economic accords that were offered by the European Union to Ukraine, though little advertised, included military agreements that called for closer military cooperation with the European Union, which in plain language means with NATO. What would that have meant for Russia, which has its main naval fleet stationed in Ukraine by legal treaty, historically, the Black Sea Fleet? Geopolitically, had Ukraine signed this and had these accords played out politically, economically, and militarily, this would have been a catastrophe for Europe and not a good thing. It would be creating, so to speak, as was Berlin during the old Cold War, a new Cold War line through Europe, now drawn right through the heart of Slavic civilization, right through Russia and Ukraine. I mean, in whose national security interest could that possibly be?
Well, that's a good question. Wasn't it back when the Soviet Union collapsed and didn't Gorbachev offer, he disbanded the Warsaw Pact, and I believe President Clinton promised that NATO would stay put and not try and advance up to this new borders, but we broke that promise.
Well, this is going to be one of the, and you make the right point, one of the critical questions of historical interpretation that future historians are going to argue about. In 1990-91, in return for agreeing to the reunification of Germany, and the first President Bush was President of the United States at that time, Gorbachev agreed to the reunification of Germany on the condition, as then Secretary of State James Baker said, NATO would not move one inch to the east from Germany. In other words, there would be no expansion of NATO eastward. Bush honored that agreement, but when Clinton became president in 1993, he moved soon to begin the movement of NATO eastward, like Pac-Man, gobbling up all those countries between Germany and Russia. And now, as I said before, NATO includes the three small Baltic republics, nations, Estonia, Lithuania, and is right in Latvia, and is right on Russia's border, as well as Poland. From the Russian point of view, that was the first of many broken promises that America made to Russia. The American reaction was, first, we never said that, but many eyewitnesses, including Condi Rice, a subsequent Secretary of State, said, yeah, that was the promise. To which the Americans say, Gorbachev should have got it in writing. Well, that's a kind of used car dealer approach to things. Mm-hmm. But they're right. In international affairs, there are no permanent friends or allies. There are deals that sometimes are held together by treaties. Gorbachev should have got that in writing in form of a treaty. He didn't. We violated our promise, and the Russians have never forgotten it.
Well, this is Per Fagrang. The show is Fight the Empire. My guest is Professor Stephen Cohn, who has written extensively on Russia, and we're talking about the situation in Ukraine. Do you think the U.S. is trying to encircle Russia, or really trying to get into the Asian? You know, there is this kind of theory, the heartland theory. There was some he wasn't a diplomat, but he was some kind of a British thinker, Halford Mackinder, who said that whoever controls this great Asian heartland, kind of runs the world. And it was said that one of Kissinger's nightmares was if the Soviet Union and China ever did get together. And now they are, they do have this kind of cooperative arrangement, and it seems to be picking up steam. And is that what's going on there now, that the U.S. is trying to break up this sort of make an entry into the heartland, or what?
I've thought about this for the last 20 years, because I think this American policy, this winner-take-all, this march on Moscow's security areas, is terribly detrimental to our own national security. I mean, just from our own selfish self-interest, this is not in our interest. We've seen the alternative when Putin virtually saved Obama's presidency by getting Syria to agree to the destruction of its chemical weapons. He made it possible for Obama to avoid what Obama desperately did not want to do, that was launch an attack, military attack on Syria. And also Russia, in the form of Putin and his foreign minister Lavrov, have been behind the scenes in bringing about this tentative accord between the United States and Iran on their nuclear weapons program. So we see what a partnership with Russia can mean for our own national security. So why have people in Washington, the most powerful people, and fully supported by the mainstream media, pursued this kind of all-out march on Moscow since Russia ceased to be the Soviet Union? I don't know the answer. I think probably some pointy-headed types in think tanks who whisper into the ears of the State Department and the President do give them this theory of the heartland, that whoever controls Eurasia, that's the area, let's say, from Ukraine to Central Asia, controls the world. But it's an obsolete notion in the era of globalization and missiles, which can fly across this area in 5 minutes. I mean, that was based on some 18th, 19th century of troops and ships. There probably is this kind of intellectual package going on. I think it's also Russophobia, hatred of fear of Russia, the Russian Empire, evil Russia. Mm-hmm. Russia will always be evil. Russia will always be an enemy. I don't know where this began.
Except for Boris Yeltsin.
It may have begun before the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. with our grandfathers who came here because of pogroms and brought that attitude here. But clearly in our lifetime, it's a legacy of the Cold War. And our policy makers are the product of the Cold War. Still all of them, they were, if they weren't in positions of power, and many of them were, they were in school, they were absorbing the popular culture. But wherever it comes from, it is so bad for, I think, the United States and for Russia, that one yearns for an American president who could break out of it. Now, Clinton, Bush, and Obama will say they tried, and it's all Putin's fault. But the reality, they tried on their own terms. That is, we are asking the following concessions from you, but we don't have anything to give you in return. And then the Russians say that's exactly what you did when you moved NATO toward us. I mean, I don't know how many Americans remember that after the attack on the United States on 9/11, Putin was the first foreign leader to call George Bush, the second Bush, and say, George, whatever you need, we're here to help you. And in fact, the details are too many. But what Putin's Russia did for the United States during the first American land war against the Taliban in Afghanistan saved many American lives. Putin expected something in return for Russia. And what did he get in return? Well, within 2 years, the second George Bush had moved NATO even closer to Russia, and Bush withdrew the United States unilaterally from the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which prevented the building of these missile defense systems, which Russia regarded as the bedrock of its national security. So there was an act that the Putin government regarded as somewhere between ingratitude and betrayal. These things matter. As one Russian leader comes and goes, as Russian elites grow up, they remember this American behavior that we give to the Americans, and what we get in return is either broken promises, deceit, or betrayal. And if you travel in Moscow in these circles, as I do, these are the words in Russian that you hear about us. And it's hard for a knowledgeable American to say, oh, no, you're wrong. We're virtuous people. We're honorable people. Because this is the political history, the reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Americans seem to have some sense of entitlement or something. You know, maybe they never forgave Putin for not being Boris Yeltsin and giving away the store.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I heard one American policymaker say about maybe 10 years ago, after they got a fix on Putin, we were misled. We thought he would be a sober Yeltsin. Well, he turned out to be sober, but he wasn't Yeltsin at all. But we ought to make one distinction. There's no evidence in the public opinion surveying that's done in the United States that the American people think this way about Russia. None whatsoever. This is the ideology of our political policy media elite. It's their ideology. It's their foreign policy. And it rarely becomes an issue in American elections for various reasons. But until that elite thinking changes, the policy isn't going to change.
Well, what would a Ukrainian economy need to thrive? You know, they're famous for being kind of the breadbasket of the region. Could Ukraine be a kind of an agricultural economy and still thrive, or do they need industry? Their industry seems to be falling apart. But
well, their problem is that they have been historically, I mean in the 20th century, two economies. And again, partly east and west. The eastern southern part of the country is very heavily industrial. And this includes defense, technological, space industries, and they are essentially intertwined with Russia's industries of that sort. That is, that what they build, what they create, has been done historically jointly with Russia and on Russian contracts, defense contracts. So one of the things that Putin offered Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, a couple days ago, was more defense contracts to bolster the flagging heavy industrial eastern part of Ukraine. That's clear. Surely Ukraine, as you say, has been a breadbasket and could become an agricultural wheat exporting country. But Russia's trying to become that as well. Like most former Soviet economies, Ukraine needs to diversify. And what does that mean in the modern world? Well, does it mean McDonald's, which is not exactly an upwardly mobile employer in the United States either, or does it need high technology? And if you want to become cutting edge technologically, That means computerizing the country. That means recasting your education. That means a whole new generation of students. Those young people are coming on. We see them in the streets in Kiev, and they're coming on in Russia. And that is part of a country's future, Russia and Ukraine. But this notion that somehow all of us will rebuild our economies based on technology begs a larger question in my mind, and that is manufacturing. I mean, this is a problem in the United States, too, now. 3% of Americans produce our vast agricultural surpluses. Where do the rest of the people go? Now, in Ukraine, the population is diminishing every year very substantially. That's a bad thing. Though cold-hearted economists will tell you, well, that's a good thing. Less pensions to pay, less people to employ. I think a lot of this talk about globalization, technology, the computer will save us, hasn't been thought through. But meanwhile, in the transition, which is somebody's lifetime, people are going to pay, a lot of people are going to pay a terrible price. And we're seeing that here in the United States. One of the reasons that we have unemployment is that we don't have enough people suited for the jobs that do exist. I mean, McDonald's can't hire all the unemployed here, Ukraine, or in Russia. And it doesn't add much to the national economy. It's more of a service industry. It's manufacturing and production. In the United States and in Russia and in Ukraine, defense industries perform that role. But a lot of us wish that they'd cut back on those defense industries here and there and move that money into other kind of manufacturing. But all that requires a new kind of leadership. That's what Obama said he was about in the United States. You remember high-speed trains and high technical industries, doing what the Chinese and the Japanese have beat us to for a number of years. But it's hard.
Well, I think it also requires cheap oil, which seems to be a thing of the past. And but that would be a whole new topic and require a whole new program. But
That's true.
One last quick question. You think there's any chance that Ukraine may split up? There are people in the Crimea who actually had a secession movement not too long ago.
Yeah, I think there is a chance. I think if the West keeps pushing, that's a very likely possibility. I think if the United States and Europe back off and Russia doesn't push its advantage, that it will now become part of the political process of Ukraine, which has elections. Mm-hmm. And some people have proposed they should have a referendum and ask people, do you want to be of Europe or do you want to be with Russia? The problem is the referendum would probably be so divided that in the end, you would have a de facto partition of Ukraine. So the next discussion somebody needs to have is whether that would be good or bad for anybody.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. We've been talking with Professor Stephen Cohen, who's written a lot on Russia and the Soviet Union. Do you have a website where people can kind of stay in touch?
I'm like Ukraine and Russia. I'm kind of old-fashioned. I don't have a website. A number of my articles are on the Nation magazine,
nation.com.
Uh-huh. So that's probably the easiest thing to find what I've written and said in recent years.
So keep your eye out for Stephen Cohen in the Nation magazine. Thank you very much for being
Thank
with
you.
Us.
Thank you very much.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. It is now a minute before 10 o'clock. In 15 minutes, Flashpoints Today presents excerpts from Dreaming Wildly, Fighting to Win, a conversation with Angela Davis and Martin Espada, recorded in early November in Oakland, California. And at 11, it's a special 1 hour Between the Covers with host David Naiman speaking with Veronica Gonzalez Pena about The Sad Passions, her novel of a middle-class Mexican family torn apart by mental illness. But first, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, and that is coming up next. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a member, you can become one now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Tune in to Between the Covers every Thursday at 11 a.m. to hear interviews with locally and nationally known authors from both fiction and nonfiction. Between the Covers, only on KBOO Portland.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, December 19th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. First, a few headlines for our guest to set today, Ray McGovern. He'll be answering a few questions that we have for him regarding Jeff Bezos of Amazon, the Washington Post, and the CIA. It all comes together. And Christopher Gray, contributor to the Lund Report, reveals how the Department of Health and Human Services' utter failure to fund, as promised, employment and training programs for the disabled. And Senator Ron Wyden is introducing today his bill to promote logging